two major surprises in just two episodes. It's clear that the new season of Sherlock is on a roll. Unless you want to learn what these surprises were from us, make sure you've seen episodes 1 and 2 before listening. Masterpiece Studio is brought to you by Viking Cruises, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at vrc.com. I'm Jace Laycobb, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. In a weird, somewhat unexplainable way, John Watson and Sherlock Holmes make a great team. Even from the very beginning, John understood Sherlock in a way that no one else could. But now that Mary's gone and the team's dissolved, both John and Sherlock find themselves in a very bad place.
Burning up. I'm at the bottom of a pit and I'm still falling, and I'm never climbing out.
But in death, just as she did in life, Mary Watson is able to reunite the misfits. Together, John and Sherlock confront Culverton Smith and some other painful realities.
I'm not the man you thought I was. I'm not that guy. I never could be. But that's the point. That's the whole point.
But the episode doesn't end there. In a scene 3 years in the making, the identity of the third Holmes sibling is revealed, punctuated by a gunshot.
I never did that scene where her identity is revealed without a chill running up my spine.
Since this could be the end of Dr. John Watson, we're taking a look back at all of the big moments from the past 4 seasons of Sherlock with actor Martin Freeman. This week, we are joined by Sherlock star Martin Freeman. Welcome.
Thank you.
This is a highly emotional episode. What was it like to tap into John's grief?
Grief is it's a hard thing to play if you're... Well, it's because it's such an extreme state of mind and state of being that if you're not feeling it, it's quite tricky. You have to dig a bit, and if when necessary, you have to just make it up. But I don't know. I think John's always feels to me like he's on the verge of stopping himself either exploding or slapping someone or something, you know. So I, difficult is the answer to that. How it was to tap into his grief is difficult because it's also not a very nice place to stay. You know, it's not a very nice place to inhabit for a few days.
Now, John and Sherlock have had bumpy patches before. Mm-hmm. Why is this rift with Sherlock so different?
Because I blame him for the death of my wife. And so I think all the stuff that I felt about Sherlock anyway as John is being given voice and is being given full reign. Because, you know, Sherlock has always pissed John off, always. As well as loving him, he also wants to slap him quite a lot of the time. And I think this is John's way of giving vent to that. He's allowing the loss of his wife to... to give him license to go, yeah, and it's your fault, you it was you. You said you would look after her and you didn't. And of course, like most of those things, it's misplaced because what John's really thinking is I couldn't look after her. I didn't stop her from dying. But rather than dealing with that, I'm going to blame you.
John engaged in an emotional affair with the mystery woman from the bus.
And this girl just smiled at me. That's all it was a smile. We texted constantly. You want to know when? Every time you left the room, that's when.
Should that change our perception of John Watson?
It might change your perception. I mean, for me, it doesn't particularly change your judgment of a person. But it's literally new information for the audience about John because we haven't heard that about him before. I think, generally speaking, all you've seen of John is him being very decent and very loyal to Sherlock. And, like, you know, he's a decent professional doctor, ex-soldier. It might change your perception of him literally just because you are seeing that. But I hope it won't change people's judgment of him because, well, unless you've got certainly different to make up than I have, then I think we've all engaged in a bit of emotional jiggery-pokery at some point. You know, I imagine it's almost impossible not to, isn't it?
Emotional jiggery-pokery might be the name of my new band.
Yeah, emotional jiggery-pokery. I've never said that before. You can have that for your band.
I'm keeping it. I'm keeping it. It's mine.
As long as I get credit on the sleeve notes.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the mystery woman's identity is revealed at the end of The Lying Detective.
Who are you?
Isn't it obvious? Haven't you guessed? I'm Eurus.
How does her presence shake up the relationships on the show?
Well, it's obviously a massive bomb that is dropped for that family, for the Holmes family. I can only really say to, you know, what it was like from my point of view. I never did that scene where her identity is revealed without a chill running up my spine. You know, so however many takes we did, I always felt cold as it was revealed. I loved it, loved it.
My parents loved silly names like Eurus or Mycroft or Sherlock. Oh, look at him. Didn't it ever occur to you, not even once, that Sherlock's secret brother might just be Sherlock's secret sister?
And of course, yeah, it changes everything for the Holmes brothers. And as a result, if something changes for that deeply for Sherlock, then something has to change a little bit for John because they're best friends.
Were all of you just sort of laughing at the notion that Tom Hiddleston was supposedly playing Sharonford?
I didn't hear that actually until, well, I only heard that after we stopped shooting. So I didn't know. I heard about Taylor Swift as well, that she was going to be something in it. I guess it was a job lot. It was, you know, while they were together, it was two for the price of one, maybe.
What was it like filming the emotional resolution between John and Sherlock in The Lying Detective?
It's hard, actually. It was hard. Because it comes off the back of very painful stuff between John and Mary.
She was wrong about me.
Mary, how so?
She thought that if you put yourself in harm's way, I'd rescue you or something. But I didn't, not till she told me to. And that's how this works. That's what you're missing.
So it was hard being, like I say, it's hard sort of sometimes just being in some states because it's not pleasant. And sometimes if you, there was a really annoying thing actually that day that I thought, it's a big scene. It's a very big scene between Amanda, myself, and Ben. And I thought I'd got it. And then we broke for lunch and I was gutted because I thought, oh no, I've got to come back to this. We didn't finish it. And I was very anxious about it after lunch. Very anxious. And actually, Ben was very good. He took me aside and sort of calmed me down, just said, you know, take a deep breath sort of thing. So I did and sort of allowed the scene to come back.
She taught me to be the man she already thought I was. Get yourself a piece of that.
If it can be you are doing yourself a disservice. I have known many people in this world but made few friends, and I can safely say
I cheated on her.
But it was, yeah, it was not an easy day. It was a fulfilling day once we'd done it, because it's a really good scene. It's a really well written scene. So hopefully we'll do it well. But it was. That's what it was. That's the answer to that question there.
I mean, what happens after that? Is there a switch that's flipped and you're done? How do you pull back from that sort of raw emotion? Is there an antidote?
For me personally, then you just call cut and then the end of the day happens. Yeah. And then it's just tiring. Then you're just tired. In a nice way, you know, hopefully it's in a nice way. I love that feeling as an actor of being tired when you know you've done your best and that you've spent something, you know. You should feel a bit tired sometimes. But I tend not to take things home apart from a general, you can take feelings and moods home, but I've never sort of thought, if I'm playing a baddie or if I'm playing a murderer, I've never thought, yeah, I might kill my whole family now because I'm so in the character.
So no Jared Leto as Joker method acting. You're not sending pigs to Benedict.
Why? What was he doing?
Oh, he sent like a dead pig to his cast members in Suicide Squad, and he got so deep into the character of the Joker that he was
really.
Yeah, he went a little mad.
No, I don't. I mean, I think each to their own, of course. But I find, focus helps, and doing what you need to do helps. You know, if that just means shutting up for an hour and not having a laugh with anybody. But no, once it's over, I have no... You know that thing that you were doing at 4 o'clock? That was fiction. That was your job. Now you've got to put the tea on. You know, it's kind of, for me, reasonably straightforward. Although, of course, there can be a bleed of a feeling or a mood. You know, if you spend all day screaming and shouting, that's going to have a different feeling at 8 o'clock that evening than if you spent all day flirting and kissing. You know, they are different feelings, definitely. But either one of them is not real. So, yeah.
On the subject of feelings, is Sherlock as oblivious to people's feelings as we, the audience, perhaps believed?
It's funny because we sort of talked about that occasionally. Or, you know, obviously it purports more to Ben, but of what he has to play. I think obviously generally it's known that he is pretty blind and deaf to people's feelings. But I think there are moments where Sherlock knows more than he's letting on. You know, I think sometimes he uses his reputation that everyone in the room thinks he's completely blind and deaf to something. He uses that as cover, I think, sometimes, that he is able, I think occasionally he's able to see more than he's given credit for. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe I've just hurt your feelings, but I don't really care because I've got this other case to solve, as opposed to I have no idea that I've hurt your feelings. I think sometimes he genuinely doesn't have an idea. And we see that certainly in the earlier episodes of the show. But then other times, I think there is a little glint in the eye, almost invisible glint in the eye, where he knows, but he just doesn't care, maybe, you know.
Now, the series to date has been full of very malevolent baddies, but Toby Jones's Culverton Smith seems to be pure evil incarnate.
You know, in films, when you see dead people pretending to be dead, and it's just living people lying down. What's not what dead people look like? Dead people look like things. I like to make people into things. Then you can own them.
Yeah.
What did Toby bring to the role, and what was it like playing opposite him?
Well, Toby is just a very good actor. So he brought that, and he brought it those chops and that craft that he has. Working with him was really good fun. I've worked with him before, like 10 years ago. And we ended up laughing a lot, actually. He's very naughty. You know, like he just likes f***ing about, basically. But yeah, he does, for someone who's as nice as he is, he does a very good line in Spooky. You know I mean, like he does a good line in something just a bit off. And certainly in Culverton Smith is very off. You know, it's very, very off. Because Moriarty is at least charming. Do you know what I mean? Moriarty's funny and he's camp and he's charming. Whereas Culverton Smith is just like an ooze. You know what I mean? He's like a sort of oozing sore, you know.
Before we get to the next question, a brief word from our sponsors. Masterpiece Studio is brought to you by Viking Cruises. See the world differently by exploring differently. Learn more at vrc.com. Masterpiece Studio is also brought to you by Farmers Insurance and their 88 years of experience, helping people so they can prepare for the unexpected. They know a thing or two because they've seen a thing or two. Find an experienced agent at farmers.com. And we're back now with Martin Freeman.
Thank you.
What was it like filming Mary's climactic death scene opposite Amanda?
Oh, it was hilarious. Nothing I like more than seeing Amanda get shot in the chest. It was hard. I mean, you know, again, it's almost impossible to go there. You know, you kind of think, oh, this is Amanda. This is the mother of my children. This is not, I can't glibly just think, oh, wow, just imagine she's been shot in the chest. Because obviously if she was shot in the chest, that would be my life almost over, you know. So I can't go there easily, obviously. And with that, there is always the danger of bad acting, you know. So my jury is still out on that. I'll know when I've seen it if I'm okay with it. But it was hard. It was hard.
John, I think this is it.
No, it's not.
You made me so happy. You gave me everything I could ever, ever want.
Mary? I mean, I do remember the look he gives Sherlock afterwards is of a wounded animal, you know, who will kill him if he comes any closer. You know, I don't want to be anywhere near you now. Because, of course, I don't know what to do with these feelings, so I'm going to have to blame my best friend, because he's the only other person in the world who I really care about. So he has to blame Sherlock, you know. Or he'll just die. Yeah, or he'll just kill himself or something. So it all goes on Sherlock's shoulders, and he hates Sherlock for that time being until he has to acknowledge that maybe he doesn't hate him.
You didn't kill Mary. Mary died saving your life. It's her choice. No one made her do it. No one could ever make her do anything. But the point is, you did not kill her.
Yeah, it was not easy, basically. Not easy. And I may well have done some bad acting, and I really hope I haven't come January the 1st.
You haven't.
So apologies if I have.
You haven't.
I bet you say that to all the boys.
you've said you botched your first audition for Sherlock. Your wallet was apparently stolen on the way to the audition. What happened?
Well, for a start, I really don't remember my wallet being stolen on the way. I don't remember losing the wallet. I don't remember any of that. That came up later on. I don't know whether that was a lie that I said in the audition to make to justify my state of mind. I really, really don't. I swear to God, can't remember my wallet going. I do remember not being in the highest of spirits, and I can't really remember why. With me, it could be anything, to be fair. Could you take your pick? Could be anything. But I remember thinking I wasn't firing at 100%. I also remember in that kind of symbiotic way where you're not sure if it's you bringing it into a room or it's being reflected back to you. When I went into the room, I also thought, oh, maybe they're not that keen on me either, you know. But I was in Los Angeles, actually, and I was staying at the Chateau, as showbiz people are wont to do. And I said to Michael, my agent, well, did anything come back about Sherlock? And he said, yeah, they didn't really feel, to be honest, they didn't really feel you were that up for it. And I'd say, I really am up for it. Because by that time I'd read the script and I knew it was a good piece of writing. I said, will you please let them know that I was up for it? I don't know what happened. Sorry if it was me. Sorry. But I'm really up for it. So they got me in again, and I read with Benedict. It's now weird because this story's been told so many times by so many people. It's like, and Brian Epstein went down into the cavern and there were these four Liverpool lads and the rest was history. clearly nothing is ever that emboldened when you're doing it in real life. But it was a good read. He was already the part. It was always going to be Benedict who was playing it. When I read the script, I'd heard it was going to be Benedict Cumberbatch. And I'd seen some of his work. And I thought, oh, wow, he's really good. He'll be great in that. So he was already cast. But they were searching around for John a bit longer, I think. And when we read, as this is Mark and Stephen's words, they could see the show, which is lovely. Makes for a good showbiz anecdote.
It does. You said in an interview with Vulture that your reaction to both Fargo and Sherlock was initially the same. Really, do we need that? But that after reading the first few pages of both projects, you were sucked in. What was it about Sherlock specifically that made you change your mind?
It was just the quality of the writing. I can't remember a specific scene. Like, there was a specific scene in Fargo that made me think, oh my God, I have to do this. It was a scene between mine and Billy Bob Thornton's character in a hospital. It was just so beautifully written. In Sherlock, I don't think there was a specific scene. It was just from the get-go. It was very smart. It was action and intellect, you know. And it wasn't treating the audience like idiots. It wasn't knowingly cool. My fear, my initial thing was, oh my God, are we going to be rapping or something? You know, 21st century set now. Is it going to be just uber, just arch and cool? And we, you know, and I hate that. So, but it wasn't that. It was just very, very smart writing. And within a few pages of that, I just thought, yeah, well, I'm bang up for that. I must go and do an audition where I pretend my wallet's been stolen and piss everyone off. So that was my next ambition.
John has two mustaches over the course of the series run, one in season 3 and then in the Abominable Bride.
Yeah.
How much did you hate wearing them?
I hated wearing the first one, because what I realized was it, from a vanity point of view, it wasn't attractive. And also because I thought, because Mark Gatiss had had a conversation with me about having a moustache at some point in series three. And I said, why? And he basically just said, because I want you to. It was that. It was like, it was not the normal rigour of, well, I think for the character, you know. I think he and Stephen, I guess, just wanted at some point there to be a nod toward the traditional way we see John Watson, which is having a moustache. So my memory is the reason, part of the reason that John Watson shaved it off in that first episode of series three was to kind of meet me halfway, I think. But next time, the Victorian moustache, I think, was a lot more attractive, even though it was more ridiculous. Is you think, well, if you're going to have a massive moustache, have it in that way and have a bit more red in it. Because if it had been grey, I would have looked about 70.
Have you forsworn moustaches moving forward?
I have not. No, I haven't. I mean, I think there are roles that I could wear moustaches for. But I think I'd like to grow them. I think I, you know, where possible now, I will just have my own. That's the thing.
One of my favorite Sherlock sequences is the gag in the empty hearse when Sherlock returns from the dead and John can't help but sock him repeatedly in the face.
London is in danger, John. There's an imminent terrorist attack and I need your help.
My help?
You have missed this. Admit it. The thrill of the chase, the blood pumping through your veins, just the two of us against the rest of the world.
What was it like getting to punch Benedict Cumberbatch over and over again?
Well, of course, I didn't, getting to nearly punch Benedict.
Stage punch.
It was good. I mean, we'd done a bit of that before. We'd done that in A Scandal in Bohemia as well. A Scandal in Belgravia, rather, where Sherlock says, hit me, and I hit him and we have a little tussle. I think the feeling was that in the original story, The Empty House by Conan Doyle, Sherlock reveals himself to be alive and Watson faints, which is a kind of 19th century gentleman's reaction, you know, I guess. A sort of English, I'm so overwhelmed, pass me the smelling salts, I'm going to faint. I'd made it clear from the get-go, and I'm sure Mark and Stephen agreed, that was not going to cut it. Because <I mean>, like, that's not who our John is. Our John is not that. You know, he's a bit more of a bloke, you know.
Yes. In his last vow, John throws the Agra flash drive into the fire at Christmas, telling Mary,
the problems of your past are your business. The problems of your future are my privilege.
Looking back, do you think he might regret that decision now, the choice to not know?
No, I think if you asked him, I think he would, for all his blokiness, he's also quite a romantic, John. And I think he believes in love. Or that might just be me, I don't know, where we overlap. But I think he thinks love is worth sacrifice. And I think he thinks love is worth, okay, if it didn't go swimmingly, at least I did it for love. So, I don't think he would regret that now. No, I don't think so, even though it has disastrous consequences. No, I'm going to say no. I'm going to speak for him, and I think he'll stand by that decision to throw it in the fire.
There's a great moment in his last vow where John pretends to be Sherlock in the empty house and then removes his disguise after Mary confesses. And it's this huge emotional moment. And then John fixes his hair.
Oh, yeah.
Was that last bit scripted?
No, it wasn't scripted. And I know I've heard Mark say that is pure Martin. That's pure Martin because I couldn't stand to have bad hair on screen. I don't know. See, because rather like Mr. Leto, I'm so deep in character, I don't know where I begin and John ends. So it could have been John, it could have been me, I'm not sure. It's a bit of both. I mean, genuinely, yes, it might have been me because I am funny about hair. Yeah, I am. But also, John's a military man, you know, and that's where part of the casting has been quite good because I'm quite meticulous in my appearance. And so's John. You know, I think that's John's military training as well. You know, he's got to pass military muster. And he's not shabby. He's not messy. And I think also that patting down of the hair is a psychological statement as well. It's a kind of, and now I'm back to me. So no, I don't know whether that was Martin. I mean, it's kind of funny for people who know me and people who know that people who know my meticulous ways, they could go, oh, that's Martin. But also, in fairness to some of my acting ability, I do also want to serve John well. And I don't think John would walk around with messy hair either.
Looking back to the beginning of Sherlock, I love the scene in A Study in Pink when John is summoned to that creepy warehouse by a mysterious man who's revealed to be Mycroft.
I'm the closest thing to a friend that Sherlock Holmes is capable of having.
And what's that?
An enemy.
An enemy?
In his mind, certainly. If you were to ask him, he'd probably say his arch enemy. He does love to be dramatic.
Well, thank God you're above all that.
What was it like shooting that scene opposite Mark Gatiss?
It was great. It was really, really good because it had, you just aesthetically, that the shots were very sort of mid-60s British spy movie. It's very Harry Palmer. And it was, you know, Mark is a delightful person. Mark is a, he makes everything easy. He makes everything pleasurable. And I just, yeah. And also that was, it was directed by Paul McGuigan, who, as any Sherlockian knows, casts a long shadow on this show, you know. And he gave me a really good note. He gave me a really good note of that this is great economic directing. During that scene, as Mycroft is trying to kind of do me down and trying to undermine me, my John's reaction was to kind of smile, to bluff it out and smile and laugh and like, yeah, like in a kind of you way, you're not getting to me. And he just came over and said, I think you should try it. Try, don't smile. And it was a really good, very informative and instructive piece of directing. Because I think what's in there is the straight version of me not smiling, you know.
When one is avoiding the attention of Sherlock Holmes, one learns to be discreet, hence this place. Your leg must be hurting you. Sit down.
I don't want to sit down.
You don't seem very afraid.
You don't seem very frightening.
Yes. The bravery of the soldier.
Any scenes between John and Mycroft I really like because you know it's going to get done. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, this is going to be, yeah, we'll get done by lunch. But not only done by lunch, because any fool can do that, but like actually get it done well by lunch. I love it, you know.
Do you have a favorite scene from the series so far?
Of all the episodes?
Of all the episodes, your personal favorite scene you've done?
I do not, actually. No, I don't. I mean, there are a lot to choose from. No, I don't, actually. I'm very lucky. Well, we're all very lucky in the show. We are given really good stuff to do and to say and to play. So that within that 90 minutes, I get to play pretty much everything. I mean, pretty much everything. I get to kick a bit of a... I get to, you know, get very upset. I get to say funny stuff. I get to laugh. I get to chase people. I get to flirt and fall in love. It's, you know, it's very, very layered, that character. So no, I couldn't actually think of one. What's your favourite thing about all my great work?
I love everything.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? It's hard picking just one moment of my great work. It is. That's the tough one. That's the how do you single out my great work into one distilled scene? You can't. The end.
The end. This interview is running before the final episode of season 4. Mm-hmm. Mark, they love to sort of tease an episode with a single word. We know the clue for that episode is Sharonford, but if the final episode were an adjective, what would it be? If it were an adjective. Or I'll do you one better. If it were a beverage, what would it be?
A beverage. That's more, yeah. He suddenly got my, yeah, he thought, no, this guy's not that clever. Let's make it alcohol. If it was a beverage, I think it would be like a strong, well, like a strong, strong espresso, maybe. It's like it's like a shot. It's like a shot in the arm, you know, where you have to face reality. It's a kind of sobering up bit of caffeine that hits you and you feel it in your system for a good few hours afterwards.
If it were an animal, what would it be?
a Tyrannosaurus Rex. No, I don't know. It would be a panther. And I'm not shamelessly plugging Black Panther, my latest film, folks. Hi, in a cinema near you in a year's time. No, but like something sleek and smart, but deadly, you know, deadly.
Deadly. What will you take away from your experience on the show?
I mean, too much really to put into words in less than an hour. I mean, it's been such a massive part of the last 7 years of my life. You know, we did the pilot in 2009. It's opened doors for me. I've made friends on it. It's been often imitated. I would argue never equaled. But I think it's a really good show that if I wasn't in, I'd be annoyed that I wasn't in it and I'd want to be in it.
That's the best descriptor. Martin Freeman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jace. Thank you.
The third and final episode of Sherlock Season 4 is wickedly good, but don't just take our word for it.
Number 3, I think, unless we've messed it up, could be maybe the best one. I don't know.
Tune into the Sherlock season finale at a new time, 7 p.m. Eastern, Sunday, January 15th on Masterpiece, or watch it online. Then stick around after the Sherlock finale to catch the premiere of Masterpiece's brand new show, Victoria, on at 9 p.m. Eastern. Let Victoria whisk you away to 19th century England and to a past where an 18-year-old girl wakes up one morning to discover that she's queen.
She may have been 4'11", but she had veins of iron, it's been described as.
Jenna Coleman, the actor who plays Victoria, joins us next time on the Masterpiece Studio podcast to dive into the lavish premiere. Subscribe to our show, Masterpiece Studio, for free on iTunes or Stitcher to get an automatic download of Jenna's revealing episode as soon as it's released. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Rachel Aronoff. This episode was edited by Kathy Tu with help from Alicia Itoop and Paul Sani. Special thanks to Barrett Brontes and Suzanne Simpson. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking Cruises, Farmers Insurance, and the Masterpiece Trust. And then we're going to do another quick outro. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the next question, a brief word from our sponsors. And we're back now with Martin Freeman.
F*** you. Is that not what you meant? That's not what you meant, is it? Thank you. Sorry, thank you, not f*** you. Sorry. Go again.